Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Well, welcome, Eric. It's a real pleasure to have you today.
Chris, good to be here, and thank you for all the work you're doing in apprising your investors of what's really going on in the world.
Oh, thank you. It's been at it many years, and unfortunately, much of what I think both you and I saw coming and many others along the way, unfortunately not enough others along the way, is really coming to pass. If I could, let's start with your views. You've been advocating and creating investment vehicles for people to own gold and silver for a long time. How did you get to that position, and what are your views on owning gold and silver at this point?
Sure. Well, you know, it all started, Chris, with sort of our studies back in 2000 that, one, we're entering into a secular bear market, and how do you deal with that? And the typical response would be to own gold and silver, which is what we decided to do. I think the one thing that really tipped us into it was sort of an analysis of the physical supply and demand for gold, and some work by Frank Veneroso suggested that things would have to change dramatically in the physical gold market because the central banks were selling 400 to 500 tons a year. And as you know, here we are 11 years later, and now they're buying for 400 tons a year on balance. And this is in a market where the mines supply only 2,600 tons a year. So that's a huge change that had to take place that Frank kind of identified back then. He also identified that the gold companies would stop hedging. We've had ETFs come along. So we've had a lot of dramatic changes in the physical balance between supply and demand in gold, and that's really what kind of took us there in 2000 to get actively involved in that particular market.
And looking at it today, has anything changed in that analysis? So you mentioned a secular bear market. Are we still in one? And also, has anything changed in the fundamental supply-demand equation that's actually tipped it one way or the other, further or less, since the initial analysis you looked at?
Sure. Well, I do think we're still in the secular bear market. And basically, what people use the phrase, you know, extend and pretend, and we had the zero interest rate policy, the housing boom, the lending boom, TARP and TELF, and all those things which tried to delay what naturally should happen. When I look at the headwinds for gold and silver, I really believe that we've been aided and abetted by a lot of these policies, particularly QE1 and QE2, and the various printing mechanisms of the ECB and the Japanese government and almost all governments in the world. So much as I would not have anticipated those types of developments happening, they have happened, and they provide an even stronger headwind for people realizing that currencies are not going to survive, and that to maintain your purchasing power, you have to own precious metals.
You know, I too have been surprised by how long all of this has stretched out. If you'd told me, hey, Chris, you know, it was 5 years ago, Eric, if you'd said, Chris, the federal government in the U.S. is going to be running a $1.6 trillion deficit, and the Federal Reserve is going to be monetizing 75% of that, and the bond markets will be relatively tame, and the dollar will still, you know, be roughly where it's at, I would have said you're nuts. But here we are, and my view on this is that what we're doing is actually we've kicked the can down the road. We bought some time. I'm thankful for the time personally. However, the risks are now increasing, and the risks that I've really identified that concerned me a lot is that sooner or later, much is happening in Greece right now, where suddenly the world wakes up and says, hey, wait a minute, they can't possibly pay that back. And at 22% interest rates on two-year paper, they really can't pay that back. So suddenly the illusion is lifted. We I guess, collectively suddenly go, I guess Greece is insolvent. Oh, that's terrible. You know, and now we're grappling with that. But that same dynamic can be extended to, I think, any of the governments you just mentioned. It varies across Europe somewhat, but Japan and the U.S., certainly there are fundamental mismatches between current productive economic output and the levels of indebtedness. We're printing our way to that. Is there a way that you can see that this could actually be turned around where it all sort of pencils out? Is there a solution to this that does not have to pass through a fiscal crisis and possibly a currency crisis?
Well, Chris, it's very hard to imagine that happening. And when I look at really what's happened over the last 11 years since we hit the high in NASDAQ, we basically created a problem in the world of banking business. And I always when your asset, when your paper assets start to decline. Of course, it doesn't take much of a decline to get rid of all the capital. And we've seen that in so many instances, whether it's Iceland or Ireland or now the Greek banks. And all the moves that have happened so far really have been in response to the problems in the banking system. That's why you had TARP and TELF and all those things, because the banks basically were losing deposits and somebody had to come in and support them. So it happened in the UK, it happened in Iceland, it happened in Ireland, happening in Greece as it's transpiring right now. And I think the big fear is that you can't let one banking system go down without an impact on all the other banking systems. So, you know, collectively everyone's trying to support the banking system, and I think people see through the ruse, and the natural reaction is, well, why have your money at a bank when you earn nothing? Why not have it in something that might at least maintain its purchasing power?
Well, absolutely. So all kinds of productive assets spring to mind, and wealth preservation vehicles, gold and silver being obvious. But also we're seeing it, I think, some of that dynamic in the commodity complex, in land prices, particularly for farmland, timberland. There, I think many people have come to the same conclusion, that which is that there is something structurally flawed, both internally to the whole economic and fiat money model, and also externally, which is my metaphor for bringing in peak oil and the idea that we're really going to be facing an enormous headwind of rising energy prices, no matter how we slice it at this point, unless, you know, we discover something really magnificent. And so these are all upon us. And here we are. When you look forward into this, though, there's a big debate out there around, you know, does this end up in an inflationary crunch, or do we go down a deflationary crunch? In my mind, I hold gold under both circumstances. What are your views?
Well, first of all, I can't agree with you more than I think three of the safest areas to be involved in are the precious metals, agriculture, and energy. Energy, unfortunately, might, if there's some kind of economic crisis, it could go down in the short term. But I think if you withdraw funding for the energy industry with the decline rates we have in oil and gas production, if people stop drilling, we would certainly see a very, very quick recovery. So I couldn't agree with you more. There's obviously doesn't seem to be any solution at hand to the problems, and I think people should stay focused on those particular areas.
And how would they do that in your mind? I know you've got a couple of funds that deal with these pieces. I know that I get questions all the time from people who are concerned about geopolitical risk, their jurisdictional risk, taxes. It's a very complicated environment, and I think increasingly complicated as governments struggle to maintain revenues and receipts and all of that. How do you suggest people begin to approach getting into these areas, many of which agriculture land, very, very difficult. Most people are stumped about how they would get into that particular area at all. What's your advice there?
Well, agriculture is the toughest because there aren't really that many public companies. I know that in Canada there's not much. I mean, for example, we have potash companies, which we've been active in, but there's not a lot of opportunity there that in the public domain. I guess in the private domain, people could own farmland, which you've already alluded to. But there's way more opportunities in precious metals and oil and gas, and I particularly emphasize precious metals because they're amongst the most liquid markets in the world. There's many, many vehicles available. Some have way better attributes than others. That's why we created funds where, you know, if you buy our gold or silver trusts, you can actually receive the gold or silver. Of course, they can always buy coins, which they've been doing in great quantities here. So those would be my primary recommendations to people. Buy something where you can get access to physical metal.
Physical metal. And if you were going to, do you ever give out, like, I know this is a complicated topic, depends by age and economic bracket, other things, but do you have a range for a percent of somebody's portfolio that should be allocated to precious metals?
Hey, Chris, it's a favorite question I'm asked all the time. And I always respond in the way that what I do. And I know in our equity funds, we're probably 75% involved in precious metals. And probably 30% of that is physical metals, and the other 45% is in precious metals equities. In my own instance, I'm seriously involved in owning physical gold and silver. And I do always point out that I don't have any trouble going to sleep at night knowing that I own these metals, because there's no way that they're not going to hold their value in whichever environment you have, whether it's deflation or inflation, which you mentioned earlier. And I happen to be of the view that we will see deflation in paper assets, but we will see inflation in real assets.
Deflation in paper assets, inflation in real assets. One distinction. Do you include real estate in your description of real assets?
I don't include real estate, and the reason I don't include real estate is because it's basically a function of interest rates and the economy. You know, most real estate is backed by loans, and that creates a great problem. So I would certainly distinguish, as you have, that you know, owning farmland, which is something that produces something real, is more important than owning, let's say, a commercial building that really is not producing anything but is backed by some mortgage where ultimately the mortgage lender is going to have concern that his loan won't be repaid and the price of that property would go down.
Yeah, I share that view. In this story, we get a lot of questions from people who are just sort of new to the game, and they look at gold at $1,500+. They look at silver right around 36 now. They look at the historical chart and they gasp and they say, "I can't buy now." How do you talk to people, or what's your advice around buying gold and silver now at these particular levels, or at any point in time? How would you advise people go about building a core position, say if they didn't have one?
Well, I think that the prices will continue higher. I mean, the amount of money printing is unbelievable. I just think you have to take that initial stand in terms of buying it. I kind of use the James Turk analogy. Just keep, you know, dollar averaging. We've gone up 11 years in a row. This year looks like it will be no exception. I would certainly think next year will be no exception. If we ever had a quantitative easing 3 announced, I think gold and silver would just go absolutely bonkers here. And so I just think you got to step in there and own it. That we've had these fears all the way along, you know, at $400 and $500 and $700 and $800 gold. Everyone was afraid it was a one-time thing. I don't think it's a one-time thing. I think it's a secular thing. It's going to carry on for quite a while here until we find some resolution of these problems. And the resolution probably will be some form of default where people just have to expunge debts that can't be repaid. So you got to be in some asset which won't be affected by that.
I agree. You know, I hear it a lot where people will say, well, gold's in a bubble, and they use price as the indicator to prove that. Bubbles are not indicated by price. They're indicated by psychology. A bubble is a component of social psychology. Finance is sort of an afterthought. We put prices on it. I still can go to parties and find almost nobody who actually owns any physical gold themselves, or even people who own paper representations of gold. It's still a very tiny minority, I think, in the overall investing public at this point. What I do see a lot of are ads to buy all of your junk gold, as if there is such a thing, you know. Yeah, I keep all my junk gold in a barrel out in the garage, waiting to haul it off to the local motel where they're holding a gold buying spree. I don't feel we're in a bubble yet because the psychology isn't there. The housing bubble had that psychology. We had hairdressers in Las Vegas with 19 homes. I don't know anybody who's a gold trader who's taken up gold trading at home or has become a broker or has done even owns any. What are your views here on gold being in a bubble?
Sure. Well, you know, we've done some work on that, and we kind of looked at the amount of money that had been invested in gold from 2000 to 2010. And I think the weighting in gold went from 2% of people's portfolios to 0.8% of people's portfolios. But if you just look at the rise in the price of gold over that time period, it accounted for by far the majority of the increase in the total investment in gold and silver, which really means very few people were making new investments in the area. And I think that is still the case. Yes, we've had some early movers in gold. You know, we had some of the hedge funds in the States buy gold. We recently had the Texas pension fund buy physical gold. But these are a few outliers here, and I don't think it's hit the mainstream to any extent whatsoever. And I might say in silver, I don't really see the institutional participation in silver. When we went out marketing our silver fund in October of 10, we had very, very weak response from the institutions, which sort of told me that, you know, they haven't really taken the time to study silver and the supply and demand situation there. And I think that's all yet to come in both gold and silver, that it'll hit a tipping point where people do realize exactly what's going on, and that
I agree, and I think that particularly longer-term funds who have a bigger view, right? So these are endowments, these are pension funds, these are people who are looking out across decades. I don't know how you can look across decades at silver and its fundamental supply-demand equation and its industrial utility and its potential monetary utility. For all of its pieces, I see an enormous structural shortfall over time, and that's to me a perfect investment opportunity and something that anybody with a longer view would get involved in. My silver, personally, I have every intention of at least passing it to my children, but possibly my grandchildren, should I ever have any. And it's something that that is my Rip Van Winkle portfolio, because everything I look at there says there's really not very many places for that to go, except to become far more valuable as we progress through time.
When I look at the physical silver market, I mean, there's some stunning developments. The world supplies about 900 million ounces of silver a year. But if you simply go back to the Chinese in 2005, they were an exporter of 100 million ounces. Today, they're an importer of 100 million ounces. That's a shift of 200 million ounces
from
one source in a 900 million ounce market. And when you start looking at the fact that, let's go back to 2005, there were no ETFs. Now we have ETFs that have 500 million ounces. You had hedging, which you don't have now, although there was some action put on late last year, particularly by Carlos Slim. But I think all of the physical data we see on silver is just screaming that there's a shortage. And in fact, this morning I just looked at the Silver Institute study of supply and demand for silver. And, I mean, I find it almost ridiculous that they always show supply equals demand and they have a plugged-in number for investment demand. When our own analysis suggests that demand for silver far outweighs supply, and ultimately the price has to go higher. As you've mentioned, the industrial uses, I think last year, were up something like 18 to 20%. The investment demand was skyrocketing. I don't know where all this silver is coming from. You have to ask yourself, well, who in 2005 was getting silver that today isn't getting silver if the Chinese are buying so much and the coin sales are so high? And it just boggles the mind that somebody hasn't come out and said, you know, they can't access silver. And that's the day I'm waiting for when, let's say, Eastman Kodak says, you know, they can't buy enough silver or there's not silver available. That'll really stun the silver market.
So I really want to wade into the CFTC and all of that in just a second. But I remember reading that your silver fund had bought quite an amount of silver. I think it was several million ounces. I forget the number. And that it took a number of months to actually receive it. Is that true?
Yes. When we started the fund, we had to go into the market and buy 15 million ounces of silver, which is not a lot in a 900 million ounce market. The stunning thing is it took about 2.5 months to receive that silver. And when we looked at the bars, we see some of that silver we ultimately purchased was manufactured after we purchased it. In other words, it was manufactured in November and we bought it in October. So it just told me there's no silver lying around to be delivered against contracts. And when you look at the COMEX inventories, which I think the dealer inventories are something like 28 or 29 million ounces, I mean, that's $1.2 billion. I mean, that is nothing that any one of 500 institutions could buy, and there would be no COMEX silver. So, I mean, the whole takedown of silver, the manipulation of silver that's been suggested in the lawsuits, I think stands a good chance of proving to be the case. The raid that took place on May 1st was a joke. We're just in the process of analyzing it now, and there was no way that the speculators on the long side could maintain their position when you wake up on a Monday morning and you're already down $6 an ounce, which basically would have gotten rid of all your margin already, and then they bang on 4 subsequent margin rate increases. It was a perfectly orchestrated raid by the people who were short, but I think it indicates that there was a real physical problem in the silver market, and I expect that to manifest itself as we move into the latter part of this year.
Yeah, I watched that one in real time. I was up late that night on Sunday, and I saw that huge plunge. It actually recovered a bit of that plunge, but the plunge started, I think the only markets open at that point were maybe Hong Kong or maybe Sydney, and they're tiny. So the raid started in the very thinly traded Globex market, and to me it's kind of like the analogy would be the price of beef plummets in Hawaii. one night, and the next morning all of Oklahoma wakes up and finds out that their beef is worth 20% less. It just didn't make any sense to me at all. Is that what you're seeing there?
Well, just imagine the margin calls. You know, you drop $5 or $6 like that. I mean, most people against a $48 contract probably only add up about $5 or $6 of collateral. So you have to double it overnight, and then they bang out the 4 margin rate increases. And by the time it was all over, I mean, you're down $15 off the high. Just imagine the flow of money needed to maintain your position. And, of course, now we see the evidence of what happened. I think the SLV lost 50 million physical ounces. The specs were forced to cover. The specs were forced to liquidate, and the commercials who were short the whole time were able to buy back a lot of paper silver in the process and book profits. But it's such a classic setup in the silver market to force the speculators to cover. And I mean, yes, they won that little battle, but I'm certainly don't think they're going to win the war.
And your view then is that somehow this is we've got the commercials, we've got the big banks. I presume you mean the bullion banks in this case, the players. If you don't want to name names, that's fine. But your view is that they have some outsized abilities to influence this market. Let's call it what it is. It's manipulate the market in order to extract economic advantage for themselves. Are they doing this simply because this is a bear raid strategy they know how to pull off and it's been successful and they make money at it? Or are they doing this to hold prices down? Or is it both? Or what's your view on this then?
Well, I think, Chris, when you realize how much money the shorts were losing, I mean, we had silver rally from $18 to $50, $49.50. I mean, the losses would have been monumental. They were being forced to deal with the short position. It was a perfect night for a raid because, as you mentioned, China was closed that day. The UK was closed. Nobody was really up when this decline took place, and I gather it took place on very, very few contracts. So it's a typical tactic in the precious metals market. We've seen it all along in gold. I mean, I can't tell you how many raids we've seen from the gold price over the last 11 years, but they occur with great regularity. But ultimately, they fail. And again, I refer to James Turk, and you know, he describes the gold price as it's a measured retreat by the central banks and the bullion shorters. They just know that there's a shortage of physical gold. And I always like to use the analogy. Imagine if in the world everything was the same today, save one thing. Let's say the silver price was still $5. Imagine the amount of money that is going into silver today and how much silver you'd buy at $5. I mean, you'd be buying 10 times more than you would have imagined. But the supply was relatively the same, so they have to let the price go up to decrease the physicalness of the market, that the money wanting to go in can buy fewer and fewer ounces as the price goes up.
Well, certainly you mentioned increased Chinese demand, also India, an important source of demand, and this is just economics 101. You know, if you hold the price down, demand will go up. And so I am sensitive to the idea that there are that central banks have long been interested in the price of gold, and politicians too. They like it to stay relatively tame, like they like inflation to stay relatively tame, because a higher raising, spiking signal from gold, it says something. And it says something, I think, casts aspersions on their policy decisions and other things. So, and we know this. We know that from the London gold pool in 69 and Rubin's strong dollar policy and all kinds of things, that this has been one of many things that the banks look at. So I know they look at it, and I'm sure they don't cry many tears when price of gold is held in check. But the flip side to that is that then we have more demand than we would otherwise have. And part of that process then involves, I think, a hemorrhaging of the gold and silver away from those places of low prices and towards the people who want to buy it. Are you seeing it change, you know, patterns of flows in the overall global precious metals market? I mean, grossly speaking, is it leaking from west to east?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt about it. As people assess the economic policies throughout the world, they realize the fiat currency is just paper. The demand for physical silver and gold is, of course, strongest in India and China. I think, as you noted, the interest in gold and silver in developed countries is not nearly the same as it is in the less developed countries. So I think those trends are going to continue when the developed countries catch on, which might start happening pretty quickly here with the recent data we've seen, which basically show that we're falling off a cliff. And when one of the things I challenge investors with these days is, if you don't know what's going to happen on July 1st when QE2 ends, are we all just like a herd of lemmings going over a cliff here? Because there better be a QE3 or you're going to have some economic crisis. And, of course, economic crises are not good for banks. And my ultimate view of what happened to gold and silver is people decide to take their money out of the banks. And there's only one place to go. And, you know, we've seen this happen in various countries that run into trouble. We hear about, you know, money flowing out of Greek banks, and why wouldn't it? And, you know, the next one is money was flowing out of Portuguese banks. And sooner or later, instead of just moving from bank A to bank B, people might start moving it from bank A, B, and C to precious metals, which I think is what ultimately will happen here and provide this huge supernova for gold and silver.
And I sort of dropped it a while ago, and I want to get back to it. I want to talk about what this end game might look like. I've been expecting it at some point where there will be – one way I looked at this, there might be a day where I wake up and there's two prices for silver, one that's set at the COMEX and the other one, which is what I actually have to pay to get some. And the wider that spreads, the greater the pressure on the overall market. What's your opinion of you've already hinted, you've said that you think that there's not that much in the COMEX. The CFTC has been complicit in some way in helping to, preserve. The CFTC might actually be just trying to preserve the amount of silver in the warehouses by going through their margin hikes and all of that and supporting all of that. What is your view of how this actually comes into fruition if we suddenly see this shortfall? Eastman Kodak says, hey, where's the silver? We want it. We have to stop our industrial processes until we get it. Tell us about that moment and how that comes about.
Well, first of all, I think COMEX is a joke, and I think all the paper markets are a joke. As you're probably aware, we trade 1 billion ounces of silver a day, 1 billion ounces. The world produces 900 million a year. And, you know, rather than us saying, well, the buyers are speculators, what's the seller thinking? He's trading 1 billion ounces on the sell side, and there's all of, 28 million in the COMEX. There's obviously a shortage of silver. What is the guy selling it thinking? He's the guy with the unlimited losses, at least the guy long silver. He knows what his loss can be, but the guy shorting silver, we've already seen silver from a year ago go up by 150%. I mean, just think of the outsized losses. So I don't really think that the COMEX and the LBMA are serving much purpose in terms of supposedly being involved in the physical markets. They're not physical whatsoever. They're just paper markets. And on a daily basis, at most, we probably get about 1 million ounces of silver every day available for investment, because most of it's used for industrial. So here we have 1 million ounces available. We trade 1 billion ounces a day. I mean, it's almost beyond belief. It's surreal in a way that there would be that much trading. It's all paper. You know, I don't know how we solve what is obviously a physical shortage here. There's not much. Primary silver production is not a big part of all silver production. So, and you see the kinds of moves we have where coin sales are up 30% and, you know, industrial demand's up 20% and the demand for solar goes up 100% in silver. I mean, the numbers are astounding in terms of growth of silver demand, but the supply goes up by 3 or 4% a year. So there's no way out of the physical imbalance in my mind. Maybe we end up with two markets, one physical and one paper. I think the more likely thing is that COMEX probably defaults somewhere along the line. If somebody just stood up and said, fine, I'll take the 28 or 29 million ounces, it'd be all over. So, and that may happen someday.
Well, you raise an interesting point for me, which is why I actually prefer to own physical gold and silver. I was a pretty active futures trader for a while, but that was just a game. I am convinced that when that event comes, and it will at some point, that what they will do, the CFTC in this case and other rule setters, is they'll just change the rules, like they did with the Hunt brothers, like they always do, right? And when the going gets tough, what they do is they just change the rules and say, oh, were you long this contract? Oh, we're very sorry. We're doing a cash settlement at some arbitrary level. Like, I think the warning shot across everybody's bow should have been the flash crash, May 10th, 2009. What the NYSE did was arbitrarily ride in and say, oh, any trades that happen below this level is is as if they didn't happen. But up to this level, they happened. And what I would love to be able to do in this case is peek into the books and find out who really benefited from having the floor of the broken trades be set at that level. And I will be shocked if it doesn't turn out that it's the most well-connected players who ended up really at the best advantage off of that. So my view, and this is perhaps cynical, is that the rules get changed rather frequently, and it erodes the most fundamental underpinnings of a market, which is that it needs to be free and fair. As soon as you have arbitrariness in there, which clearly it's not arbitrary because arbitrary sounds random. As soon as you have a rule changing that clearly benefits one set of players over another on a consistent basis, it's only a matter of time before people lose faith, refuse to participate, and do what I did, which is just default into the physical market, which was a set of decisions I made a while ago.
Sure. Well, I think just the fact that, you know, the CFTC did what they did in the Hunt Brothers situation where you could only liquidate, which is a bit of a joke, and even this most recent example where, you know, you just pile on these margin rate increases as it's working for the shorters, and the fact that, you know, they've had this CFTC investigation into the silver manipulation of 08 with no results, notwithstanding Bart Chilton coming out and saying there's, it seems obvious there was some manipulation going on. So the CFTC, I think, has abandoned their principles here.
Yeah, well, it certainly there's some complicity in there. And where there's smoke, there's fire. It's not a clean story at this point. That much is absolutely clear. So what I'd like to do now is ask a really another important question for people. I think you've got some insight into here for sure, is gold versus silver. I've always maintained a 2/3, 1/3 gold to silver ratio on a value basis as sort of my general rule of thumb. And I invest in them for different reasons. Gold for me is a monetary asset. I invest in it because there's always the option value that gold will be remonetized on the international scale. Pick a number for what it might be worth under that scenario. Silver to me is still primarily an industrial metal, one without useful substitutes in many critical applications. I split those metals and don't lump them both as precious in the sense that they have the same characteristics. What's your view there?
Well, my view is this, that I think silver should trade at something like a 16-to-1 ratio to gold. If the gold price was $1,600, silver should be $100. It's always historically been the rate. If gold was made a currency, which I think it will, I think the market's already made it, the reserve currency, the general market, you still need something for exchange that's workable. In other words, you can't be exchanging, you know, 1/10 of an ounce of gold for $150. I mean, try to get it down to $10. I mean, it's impossible because whatever you would have in your hand would be so small it would be unrecognizable. And therefore, I think that when that day comes, silver would also be included as a currency. And we're sitting here with theoretically, 1 billion ounces of silver available, which today is only worth $36 billion. You can't have something as a currency that's only worth $36 billion because it serves no purpose. There's just not enough of it around. So I happen to be of the school of thought that silver should outperform gold, and we came of that view strongly about in the middle of last year, just about this time, and it's sort of demonstrated that certainly in the last 12 months, and I think that that will continue. So I tend to favor silver over gold these days.
Right, just on a price appreciation and a ratio basis, agreed, and also the fundamental supply-demand equation there is also, I assume, driving that decision at some point in that point of view. Yeah. So here we are. It's 2011. Where do you see, if you're willing to do this, where do you see gold going to? Pick a number by 2015, 20. I mean, where do you see it ultimately getting to? And what I'm really trying to back around into in this question is understanding, when do we know it's time to sell? Like there's always a time to be long, and then there's a time to exit. What does that look like for you?
Well, first of all, you can't tell where it's going to go because you have to assess events that will happen in the future that haven't happened yet. So, for example, if we both agree there's going to be a QE3, well, I have no doubt it quickly goes to $2,000. If there's QE4, 5, and 6, it's almost unlimited. So it's hard to identify a price. I just think it's for sure going higher. depending on the actions of government, that rate of escalation may accelerate here. When people ask me when it's over, I sort of look at three things. And one would be if you saw some kind of exponential move and you just thought that the gold and silver markets were become maniacal, then you might just say, okay, fine, it's over. That's number one. Number two would be if governments around the world and central banks of the world started acting responsibly, then they're taking away momentum out of the gold and silver markets. I don't see that happening, however. And, of course, the third thing, which is kind of obvious, is if they make gold and silver reserve currencies, well, you don't need to own them anymore, depending on the circumstances at the time. So those are the three things I kind of look to. The most obvious would be governments and central banks getting responsible, and I just see no signs of that whatsoever. In fact, I almost think that their irresponsibility is increasing as time's gone on here.
I completely agree. I have several of those same signposts, and I have one other one, which is keeping my eye carefully on the role of the dollar as the world's reserve currency. If that starts to slip in earnest, that's where I pile out of dollars into things, gold and silver being two very obvious choices for me at that moment. So I really need to thank you for your time here, and I follow your writings very closely. I love your missives. They're always packed with information. If people want to follow you or find out more about the funds you offer and operate, how do they do that?
Well, they can go to Sprott.com, and all the things that we write on the various markets, and as you're aware, we've been sort of focusing in on precious metals, particularly silver lately. And we have some pretty interesting analysis of the silver market. We also have given many, many commentaries on the economic outlook over the last 15-odd years. And most of those articles have been reasonably prescient in predicting most of the things that have happened. So if they go to Sprott.com, all the information is available. If they're interested in the purchase of gold and silver maple leaves, we have a little website called Sprott Money where we're involved in that market.
Oh, fantastic. Well, thank you so much for your time today. I hope we can do this again, and best of luck this year.
Thank you very much, Chris. All the best to you.
This concludes this podcast by Chris Martinson. To gain further insight into where things stand today and what might happen tomorrow, please visit chrismartinson.com. That's chrismartinson.com. Please join Chris Martinson next time to continue your journey toward awareness, understanding, and action.